Oh, so you'll have to kind of give a little approval on your computers to acknowledge that you know that you're being recorded, or at least I'm being recorded. You can choose to remain silent if you wish, but I don't have that luxury. Okay, so we spent. Actually, I'm just going to one more thing, which is Liz. How are you doing? Welcome aboard.
Good, good. Hi.
Welcome to everybody. I'm going to temporarily put everybody on mute, but the controls to unmute are in your hands. I am not. Not changing that. Okay. So feel free to, and you know the shortcut to unmute, right? If you're on a computer, you just press the space bar and you hold it down like a little microphone button. And that should unmute while you're holding it. And then when you let go, it remutes, right? You all know that little trick of Zoom? It's like, you remember the old fashioned microphones where you held the button and you to speak? So they recreated that sensation with the space bar. So if you're on mute and you hold the space bar down, you can try it. It'll temporarily unmute you, and then you can kind of push to speak. You know, that kind of push the button to speak. That's the way it works.
Testing 4, 5, 6.
There you go. See, it works. It's just one of those undocumented little features of Zoom that it's so cute, but nobody knows about it. Push to speak. Can I tell you, got to find something humorous in the context of, all right, let's jump in. Tonight's shiur is heavy. I warn you all in advance. It's a heavy topic and a heavy issue. It's just, you know, this is a heavy perek. But on the last week or two, we kind of dealt with comparisons. We were talking about parallels between the story of Amnon and Tamar and the story of Dinah and Shechem. We talked about the parallel between Amnon and the story of Yosef, and those were parallels that were parallels in contrast, meaning each one had a side that was positive that the story of Amnon and Tamar did not reflect. Yosef, who could resist Potiphar, Esha Potiphar, Dina, Shechem, whose response to Dina was a lot more responsible than in the aftermath of the event than Amnon's was. So we spent some time comparing those two events. And then we digressed a little bit into Soloveitchik's analysis of the psychology of Chet and the psychology of Amnon. Tonight's shiur is a little bit more, is one last comparison that we need to make, and it's a heavy one. So I kind of just put that out there, and hopefully it'll take us 1 week. It might take us two. We'll see how we do. But I want to go back to the text for a second. So I'm going to go back to share screen. Now let's see if this works. When I do this in the morning at shul, it crashes on me every time. So I'm hoping this will be less so. And I think we're good. Okay, everybody there? Everybody with me?
Over there.
Okay, great. So, and that's the source page we'll come to in a few minutes. But I just want to go back to the core part of the conversation between Amnon and Tamar, after Amnon grabs her, overpowers her, and you have this, where's the language that I'm looking for? Let's start with Pasuk Tet, Vatikacha et Tamasret, Vatitzok lefanav in la'achol. He refused to eat, and then he proclaimed, he said, everybody out, Totziu kol ish me'alai. And he was alone with her. He grabbed her, lie with me, my sister. She said to him, Al achi, no, my brother. Al ta'aneni, do not force me. This is not the done in Israel. Do not do this disgraceful thing. And then she continues, where am I going to carry my shame? Where are you going to carry your shame? ולא אהבה לשמוע בקולי, refused to listen, ויחזק ממנה ויענה, וישכב אותה, he took her, he forced her, and he lay with her, and then he turned all of his love and lust into hatred, וישנאה אמנון שנאה גדולה, that we talked about, ויאמר לה, he said to her, קומי, לכי, get up, leave. And I don't know about you, but the language there, starting with the phrase "vayechazik ba," that he grabbed her or he took hold of her, and concluding with this declaration of "kumi lechi," get up, leave, and combined with this proclamation that she makes, al achi, al aneni, no, my brother, don't do this terrible thing, this nivala, all of these phrases kind of ring in my head, and I don't know if it rings in your head or not, but that's okay, because the connection is to another story where you have almost the same words, different context, slightly different emphasis, but you also have a story with the same words, al achi, al taneni, nivalazot, veyachazek, ba, and kumileche, all of these phrases that we've highlighted, also in the context of the oppression or violation of an innocent woman. Talked about Dina, we've talked about Tamar, we've talked about Yehuda and Tamar, and we've talked about Yosef and Esha Potiphar. What's left on our agenda to compare? Unfortunately, one of the most, one of the darker stories in Tanakh, which is the story of Pilegesh Begiva. And that was going to require us to refresh our memories back to our study of Sefer Shoftim. So a study of Sefer Shoftim, for those who were with us at the time, goes back to 10, 15 years ago in St. Louis, and probably longer in Toronto. For those who weren't with us at the time, then, even longer. I'm not expecting anybody to remember the story. However, for reasons that are just practical and time constraints, I'm not going to be able to go through the whole parak or the whole story. It's a long story. It's a very gruesome and very intense story. But there's one particular part of it that we need to look at and highlight, and it has to do with two things. Number one, the parallel event to the story of Yehuda and to Amnon and Tamar. And number two, the status of the woman involved. And that's going to become the key to linking us back to our story together with a bunch of other events in Tanakh. So we're going to start with Shoftim Perek Yutet. There was no king. A certain Levite who lived in the area of Har Ephraim, who had a concubine, a pilegesh. Now, technically, what is a pilegesh? So let's first start with some basic halachic concepts. Technically, what is a pilegesh? Let's throw that question out there, because we're going to have to talk about pilegesh a lot. Concubine? So that's at least, let's define like the term. So in English, it's a concubine. In other contexts, explain it. What is it?
Didn't you tell us it was kind of a mistress, that they had more status than a prostitute and less than a wife?
I wouldn't quite call it a mistress. Yes, they had more status than a prostitute and less than a wife. Concubine was essentially the closest equivalent in modern society would be a common law relationship, meaning a relationship that's defined as some kind of a permanent relationship, but without the ketubah, without marriage, without documentation, without legality to it, more or less common law in today's world. It was not out of the question to have a pelegesh in a world of polygamy, right? In a biblical arena where polygamy was allowed, you could have both a isha and a pelegesh. You could have both a wife and a pelegesh, or multiple. In the case of kings, they certainly did. Shlomo HaMelech had 300 wives and 700 concubines, a whole different story. And that was it was not an uncommon phenomenon. It's very reminiscent or very similar in kind to the notion of an ama or a shivcha that marries the master or the adon, like Hagar. Sarah has no children. She encourages Avram to marry Hagar. Hagar is the shivcha. Hagar is the maidservant. In fact, if I jump down here for a moment to the psukim in Bereishit Tetzayin, where Sarai says to Avraham to marry Hagar, if you look at the way she presents Hagar to him, v'Sarai eshet Avram lo yadala, lo yadala. We'll come to the issue of birth in a little bit, but Sarai, wife of Avram, had no children. V'la shivcha mitzvit ushma Hagar, she had an Egyptian maidservant, and she said to Avram, inena atzarani Hashem, God has held me back from being able to give birth. Therefore, bona el shivchati, come and lie with my shivcha, with my maidservant, which essentially transforms her into the status of a pelegesh. And there will be a child, and that child will be attributed to me, ulai ibane mimena. And so, vatikach Sarai eshet Avram et Hagar hamitzvit shivchata, Sarai took her shivcha and gave her to Avraham, vatiten ota la'avram isha lo le'isha. She gave the maidservant, the shivcha, to her husband, Isha, as an Isha, as a wife. So there's a lot of puns and a lot of language play in that sentence, but essentially her status was to become a second wife, even though she was a shivcha, she was a maidservant. So that more or less puts her into the status of a pelegesh. Later on in Perek Chaf Aleph, when they have a child, Yishmael, and the child starts to cause trouble, and Abraham says, and Sarah says to Avraham that this cannot continue. The language there is Vatomer l'Avraham garesh et ha'ama hazot, ki lo yirash ben ha'ama hazot im bni. He had already married her, and yet Sarai still calls her the maidservant, the shivcha, or the ama, which is another name for an eved, right? The eved, or the ama, or the shivcha, these are all terms that are synonymous with each other. Again, you've taken somebody of a status of a shivcha, married her as a pelegesh, and now the question becomes, what's her status? That's already much more complicated, and we'll come back to that piece of it in the story of Abraham a little bit later. But for now, that's the context. This Levi, back, let's go back to Shoftim. This Levi has a pelegesh, and vatizne alav pelegesho, and this pelegesh is unfaithful to him, which is an odd context, right? So it's translated here as his concubine prostituted against him, which is unclear what that means, but the pelegesh was unfaithful. Again, there's no legal status to a pelegesh in the formal sense of the term, so it's unclear exactly what that means, but whatever it means, she ran away from him. And as we'll see as the story unfolds, she ran away from him, probably for good reason. Vatelech meito beit avia, she ran to her father's house in Beit Lechem. And there she remained for several months. And finally, vayakom isha, her husband, who's her husband? Who's her husband? Let's give him a description. Who's the husband? Let's call him the Levi.
The Levi living in Har Ephraim.
Right. Let's call him the Levi. I have a lot of other terms that we could use to describe him. None of them are polite. So we'll just call him the Levi for now.
But I thought they weren't married.
So that's part of the mystery. Right? She's a Pelegesh. How do you refer to the male in the partnership between a Pelegesh? And right, is he a husband? Is he a master? It's unclear. In this particular verse, he's called a husband, Vayakom Isha. Later in the Perek, we will see he is called her Adon, her master. again, it's part of that ambiguity. The status of Pilegesh is an ambiguous status and one that is complicated. Never easy to understand and never easy to process. It's not an accident that at some point or another, we abolished the institution of the Pilegesh, but in Tanakh it certainly existed, but it's complicated. I don't think I'm familiar with a single positive story in pertaining to any Pilegesh in Tanakh. I have to research that one, but that is just a fact. Yaakov Isha ve'elech achareha, he runs after her, and l'daber aliba, to speak to her heart, to entice her, to invite her back, etc. And they come to their her father's house. Ve'achazek bo chotno, his father-in-law, the lady's father, Avia Na'ara, comes, takes hold of him, brings him inside, and they sit there for 3 days, and he gives them lodgings, and they eat, etc. And then on the fourth day, they want to start the journey, and he wants to go, and the father-in-law says, no, stay another day, and he wants to get on with his trip, etc. Won't go through all the details. Okay, they're on their way home, and they come to the city of Yavus, which is the ancient Canaanite city before it was Yerushalayim. And they don't want to stay in Yavuz because it's a Gentile city. So they decide to go down to a little bit further north, the city of Giv'ah in Shevet Binyamin, because that at least is an Israelite city, is a Jewish city, and they will give him hospitality, or so they think. So they come to the city of Giv'ah, and they end up in the middle of the court, of the in the center square, Berchov Ha'ir, because nobody would take them in, nobody would give them hospitality. They behaved very much like Sodom. Guests are not welcome here. And there's a lot of parallels to the story of Sodom. We talked about that when we studied this way back when. There's an old man, he comes from the field in the evening, and he happens to also be from Har Ephraim. He just happens to be living there in the city of Givah. Ve'ish mihar Ephraim, b'hu gar b'givah. Sort of has that Lot, that role of Lot, the outsider living in the Sodom of the day, which was the Givah Binyamin. Ve'anshei ha'makom b'nei Yemini, and the locals were from the tribe of Binyamin. Nothing ever good comes from describing one person from one tribe and the other groups from the other tribes. It's not a foreshadowing well. He sees this Levi in the middle of the fields, and I have a Levi who's not being given hospitality. I have the city of the tribe of Benjamin who won't give him the time of day, and I have a stray Ephraimite who happens to be in the city of Benjamin, and he takes pity on this poor Levi. Everybody clear on the tribes? Totally irrelevant, but it just gives us a sense of what's going on here. And he says to this old man, and he says, "Vayomer Aisha Zaken, Ana Telech, where are you coming from? Where are you going?" And he tells him, "Vayomer Lav, Avim Anachnu Beit Lechem Yudad Yad Ketei Har Ephraim. We're going from Beit Lechem in the south up to Har Ephraim. I'm going back to my home, and Ve'enish Masefot Yabaita. Nobody's willing to give me a place to sleep. And I have food, I don't need food, I just need a place to sleep." And the man says to him, "Don't worry, I'll give you a place to sleep, just don't sleep in the street." Al-talan. I guess he had a premonition that sleeping in the street wasn't going to be safe. So he says, "Come inside, I'll worry about the food." Brings him into his house, he gives food to his animals, they wash their feet, they drank. Okay, now the story begins. They were making merry with their hearts. They were drinking and eating and having a feast together. Lansman, practically, he's a Levi and he's from Ephrat, but they both come from Har Ephraim. Bine anshe ha'ir, anshe b'li'al, nasabu et ha'bayit. Certain baseless men surrounding the city came, surrounded the house. Mitdabkim al hadelet, they were started pounding on the door. V'yamru al ha'ish bal habayit, they said to the master of the house, right, the old man, the zaken, and they said to him, "Hotzei et ha'ish asher ba el beitcha v'neda'enu, bring forth the man who came into your house that we may know him." And I think everybody understands the connotation of that phrase. Correct? This was not going to end well. This was not a casual hello. what they used to call knowing in the biblical sense. Vayetze alehem et ha'ish bal habayit. So the bal habayit, master of the house, went out to them. Vayomer alehem, and he said to them, now listen carefully. Al achai, al tareyuna. No, my brothers, do not be so wicked. Did everybody hear it? Right? That's the phrase that Tamar used to push Amnon away. Al achi. Don't do this disgraceful thing. Which is another hint to the fact that this wasn't a casual hello. They weren't looking for an identity card. They wanted to abuse him. And so in order to appease them, he makes them an offer, which is really quite astounding. Here's my virgin unmarried daughter and his pilegesh. Otsiana otam, I'll give you them. Anu otam, afflict them. Asu lahem atob benechem, do to them whatever you want. But la'isha ze al tasu et ha'dvar nevala hazot, but don't do this disgraceful thing to this man. So clearly somebody's got their priorities straight. Right? V'lo avu anashim lishmoa lo, but they wouldn't listen. Bayachazek, now remember what it said by Tamar? It said the whole story began by Tamar because it says that he grabbed her, correct? Let's go back to Tamar for a second. Vategesh elav lechol vayachazek ba. He grabbed her. Took hold of her. That's where it all started. It all starts here. They wouldn't listen. Vayachazek ha'ish. Now the other guy, the husband of the Pilegesh, who's inside, who's hearing this whole thing, he knows this isn't going to end well. Vayachazek ha'ish befilagsho. So he grabbed his concubine. Vayotze aleihem achutz. And he threw her out to them. And they knew her. He said, okay, you want somebody to deal with all night long here? Take her. Just leave the guest alone. They abused her all night long. Came the morning. They let her go morning dawn. She comes home in the morning dawn. And she literally falls at the door of the house where her master is. Remember what I said before about sometimes we're called her husband, sometimes referred to as her master. The status of the relationship is in question. And by morning light, she would literally had collapsed at the door. Her master got up in the morning to collect the morning paper, to begin his journey home. I don't know what he wanted to do. Vayiftach daltot habayit. He opened up the door of the house. Vayetzei lalech l'darko. And he wanted to start his journey home. Mine ha'isha pilagsho nefelet petach habayit. And behold, the woman, his concubine, had fallen, collapsed at the door of the house, v'yadeh al asaf, with her hand on the threshold, meaning she literally collapsed at the door. Probably the two most tragic words in the entire story, if not in all of Tanakh. Vayomer elea, he said to her, Kumi, nelecha, get up, let's go. There's no answer. And at that point, she was gone or near gone, unclear. Doesn't say. I'm hoping she was gone because what happens next is worse. Places her on the donkey, goes home to his home with the woman, the concubine, on the back of the donkey. He took his knife, ויחזק בפילגשו, וינתחה על עצמה, ל-12 נתחים. He took the woman, cut her up into 12 pieces, and then sent one piece to each of the tribes of Israel, and said to all of them, thus was done in Israel, come and avenge my pride and my wife, come and avenge the people against the people of Benjamin. How dare this take place in the house of Israel? All right, that leads to an enormous civil war in the next chapter and the civil war after that. And the purpose of all of this in the context of the book of Shoftim is to tell me that we've reached a point of total anarchy in all sense, both moral and religious. And I don't think it takes much to figure out that that's exactly what you have here, is total anarchy, certainly from a moral perspective. That's the story. And the parallels to Amnon and Tamar are very clear. There is this abuse of the woman. Her status is unclear. He throws her out. He takes her, and then he throws her, and then he gets rid of her, and he expels her, and he tells her. Right? The whole context of Amnon and Tamar is very reminiscent of this story of Pilagish Begiva. I share it with you because from this parallel, two very important conclusions begin a new conversation. One is that if you're going to compare Amnon to the people of Pilegesh, the people of the likes of this Levi, then you've really reached rock bottom. So I don't think that takes much imagination. Right? If the behavior of Amnon is compared to the behavior of this Levi, and the behavior of the Zaken from Har Ephraim, and their behavior is compared to the behavior of Sodom, we have a line that is very, very dangerous. But there's another point of parallel, or another point of comparison, which is very important for us. And that is that all of this is taking place because of the status of this woman. What is her status? Right? She is a
concubine.
She's a Pilegesh. In other words, and the whole story is called in all of the literature, but Pilegesh Begiva, it's all about the Pilegesh, the status of this Pilegesh, his treatment of this, or mistreatment of this Pilegesh, the abuse of this Pilegesh. Had she been his proper wife, would this have occurred? Maybe, maybe not. We don't know. But it's certainly an indictment of her status as a Pilegesh. On the other hand, if that's true, and I'm going to stop sharing that for a second, if that's true, then just roll the tape back for a second. Amnon's abuses of Tamar. Tamar is not a Pilegesh. Tamar is a princess. So we're missing one of the parallels in the story. Right? Where's the Pilegesh piece in the story? Maybe there isn't. Maybe it's just about Amnon and Tamar and the relationship and how he mistreats her in parallel to how the Levi had mistreated his Pilegesh. On the other hand, I think there is a role to identify in terms of the context of a Pilegesh here. Who is the questionable status here? It's not Tamar. It's not Amnon. It's not Avshalom. Who is the questionable status here?
King David.
Well, King David is...
Wasn't it Bathsheba?
King David, Bathsheba, it's sort of a previous story, but in terms of the players in our horizon, in our event, the questionable status is the mother of Avshalom and Tamar. Who is the mother of Avshalom and Tamar? This we discussed the last couple of weeks, right? Who is their mother? Okay, remember, the lineage here is very important. Avshalom, Amnon comes from Achinoam Yisraelit, one of David's first wives. Avshalom and let's show you the text, so we don't have to guess.
Yafat Taor.
Yeah, right. She was, Chazal identify her as an Eshet Yifator. Chazal identify her in the status as somebody who was taken captive in battle, correct? Who she was is referenced in the beginning of Perek Gimel. All the children of David in this context. The children are the firstborn, and we'll talk about the status as a Bechor, of Amnon, born to Achinoam Yisraelit. Achinoam Yisraelit was his, after he left Michal, the first person he marries is Achinoam Yisraelit. The second he marries is Avigail Eshet Naval HaKarmeli, that's Kilav. The third child is Avshalom, Ben Ma'acha, Bat Talmai, Melech Geshur, daughter, son of Ma'acha, daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. We haven't identified who this Talmai Melech Geshur is, but his daughter is Av David's wife. So either what it would seem on the face of it, which was that there is an alliance made between the kingdom of Geshur and the kingdom of David, and as part of political alliances, you had political marriages, you married the princess, right? That was pretty common. That's how Shlomo married 1,000 wives. Or, as Chazal should describe it, he had a war with the king of Geshur, and Ma'acha was taken captive, and he marries her as a Yifator, as one of these women captured in battle, which is part of an allowance the Torah makes for the context of war. Either way, her status is very different than that of Achinoam Yisraelit. And so I'm not so suggesting for the moment yet that her status is that of a Pilagesh, but if she's a Yifator, which means that she's a non-Israelite, brought in by force in the midst of battle, captured in battle, and he marries her anyway, right? That whole status of the Yifator Parsha is very questionable, very problematic, and leads to some very complicated questions about Avshalom and, by extension, Tamar. Let's go one step further. Okay? Let's take a look at the text of the Chumash. So this is Dvarim Perek of Aleph, which is a list of mitzvot, starting with Pasuk Yud, beginning of Parshat Ki Tetzeh. And there's a series of mitzvot that are listed here. There are, in fact, between Pasuk Yud and the end of the Perek, there are four primary subjects of discussion. I think on the source page, I put them listed in shorthand here in source two. So if you have the source page, you sort of have them in shorthand, paragraph 1, 2, 3, and 4. Essentially four mitzvot, you can sort of see it there. I'm going to work off the text just because it has a translation. As well. First, number one, Ki tetzeh l'milchama alevecho netano Hashem alekecha biyadecha v'shavitav shivyo. You go to battle against your enemies, God will give them to your hands, you will take captives. V'ra'ita b'shivya eshet yifator, and if you happen to see amongst the captives a beautiful woman, v'chashakta ba, you desire her, v'lakachta l'alchalisha, and you want to take her as your wife, then the Torah says, okay, here are the parameters. You have to wait 30 days. You have to bring her into the house. She has to mourn for her family. She has to mourn for her father's house, etc. And if after 30 days, then you want to marry her, okay. You're allowed to marry her. But if not, you can't just throw her out. You can't just sell her as a slave. You had violated her. You have mistreated her. And therefore, you have to pay her. You have to give her the respect that she deserves. Those are the parameters of the mitzvah or the halacha of Eshet Yifator. Right, all familiar with the basic laws of Yifator. It's a very complicated halacha. It basically is one of those moments where you raise an eyebrow and say, what was the Torah thinking? Until Chazal come along and say, well, in a world in which this was happening anyway, and in a world in which people were taking captives and doing what they wanted with them, up until the modern era, that was still happening. The Torah placed parameters to that passion of the common soldier and said, here are the laws that at least will preserve some level of integrity and human dignity. That's the mitzvah of Yifator, number one. Number two, And this is the next paragraph. If you have a, if you're looking at it here, in a Tanakh, there is a little samach there that says this is a new paragraph. Unfortunately, in this online version of the Mikvah Gedolot, you don't see the paragraph breaks. I apologize for that. Let's see if we do it this way. Does the paragraph breaks? No. Okay. Nothing I can do about that. But there, trust me, there's a paragraph break there. Next paragraph. Itiena le'ish shtei nashim. A man could potentially have two wives. Now, polygamy is allowed, right? We don't encourage it. Rabbi Gershom 1,000 years ago banned it. Biblical account of Tanakh never bodes well for polygamous relationships, with the exception of the king's status, which was always an issue. But nonetheless, it does exist. Ki tiyena le'ish shtei nashim, achat ahuva ve'achat snu'a. One loved, one despised. V'yaldu lo banim, and these two women will have children. And it'll occur by the mazel luck of the draw that the ben habachor lasnia, that the firstborn will be born to the hated one. And now you have a problem, because the father naturally wants to favor the child of the loved, preferred one, and the firstborn is that of the despised one. And so the Torah says, "Vayabiyom hanchilot banav et asher yelo," when he bequeaths his children that which he has, lo yuchal levaker et ben ahava upneas ben asnua bochor. He cannot make the son of the beloved the firstborn over the son of the hated. But on the contrary, the normal double portion of the firstborn, who that should have gone to the child of the despised wife, that cannot be rejected. He deserves the firstborn. He is in fact the firstborn, and no amount of wishing it otherwise can make it so. If you're as confused as I am, what on earth are we talking about? There's two wives, it's bad enough. I mean, there's one wife who's despised and one wife who's loved, and one child from the despised wife is the firstborn, the child of the loved wife is the loved one. And it's all about Yerusha. Well, so first of all, that it's all about Yerusha makes sense, because unfortunately, after a person passes away, many of the conflicts that are going on, multi-generational conflicts, usually happen around Yerusha. But what on earth is going on here? I'm just kind of confused. But okay, that's paragraph 2. Yitien le'ishtei nashim. Little samach there tells me, end of paragraph. Third paragraph. Okay, third mitzvah. What's the third mitzvah in this list of happy-go-lucky mitzvot? Ki yele ish ben sorer u'moreh. A person will have a child who will be a rebellious and stubborn child. And then u'shameh b'kol aviv v'kol imo. This ben sorer u'moreh, this rebellious child, doesn't listen to the voice of his father or his mother, and v'yisru oto, and they will chastise him, v'lo yishma lehem, and they still won't listen, v'tafsu bo aviv imo, and his father and mother will take him, v'otsu oto ziknei yiro, v'el shama komo, and take him to the elders of the city in the gates of his place. And then they'll say to the elders, v'yamu azkenim, this child of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He doesn't obey us. He's a glutton. He's a drunkard. And therefore, all the people of the city will stone him to death, the child. You'll put away this evil from your midst. And all of Israel shall hear and shall fear and shall never do this again. And no child could ever be rebellious again, considering the consequences that the Torah lays out for a child being rebellious. Now, we all know that that is a fiction, and Chazal is very clear about the fact that such a story will never happen, has never happened, will never happen. And yet, why is it here? No parent is going to take the child to the court and say, this child is a glutton and a drunkard, doesn't listen to us, and the court will put the child to death. That's absurd. But nonetheless, that's the mitzvah in the Torah, and it's there for a reason. Mystery. Okay? That's the third paragraph. Then I have the fourth paragraph. What's the fourth mitzvah? Ki talini v'latol etz. Sorry. Ki yeh le'ish mishpat, chet mishpat mavet. You have somebody who commits a capital offense. And we have capital crime in Israel, in the laws of the Torah. We have a Sanhedrin. They can put people to death for capital offenses. Milmat, a person can be put to death in that context. The talito tal etz. You will hang him on a tree. All to see. No, says the Torah. Lotalin livlato ala etz. You cannot keep the body. That was standard practice. That was routine in the rest of the world. Those who had died by the hands of the court or the hands of the state as a public hanging statement to the rest of society, says the Torah, that is in violation of the dignity of the human being. Lotalin livlato ala etz. A person has within them a soul that reflects the sanctity of the divine. Kavor tik perenu b'yomahu, you shall surely bury them on that day. This is the source of the requirement to bury people quickly and not to leave people unburied for a period of time. Ki kililat Elohim talui. For the curse of God is hanged. V'lot tamet at matcha, you shall not defile your land. That's the fourth mitzvah in this sequence. So just to recap, I have four mitzvot in a row, the beginning of Parshat Ki Tetzé. The wife or the woman captured in battle that the soldier desires and marries, and the allowance for it. The two wives, one hated, one loved, the hated wife has the firstborn child, the Torah says, the Bechor goes to them. The rebellious child, the Ben Sorer Umoreh, and the rule that you cannot leave somebody, that is a violation of the dignity of the human being to leave somebody hanging on a tree. Parsha Ki Tetzé is a very difficult parsha for very obvious reasons. What is going on here? So, and what relevance does it have to our subject at hand? So the truth is that what lies at the core of this story is not each individual mitzvah involved in this sequence. What lies at the heart of this is what Chazal heard. And what Chazal heard was not four separate mitzvot, but they heard a sequence of mitzvot. They heard a story unfolding. And the story starts with the following statement. If you take the woman in captive, and you take her as your wife, be warned, nothing good emerges from such a union. What's the next paragraph? That could be that the soldier's already married. Now suddenly he has two wives, the wife he married and the wife he found in battle. Two wives, shtei nashim. And the relationship with them are very different. One is loved, one is not loved, one is rejected, one is accepted, whatever the context is, whatever that status is, we'll talk about that momentarily. But from such a child, from such a union can be born a child that can also become complicated, because that's rebellions are grown out of such unions. Rebelliousness can be the consequence of such an event. Certainly that's how Rashi understood. And if you look at Rashi on these psukim, Rashi makes it very clear. He says, "Lo tibrat Torah ela keneged yetzer hara." The Torah is speaking in direct response to the yetzer hara, to the evil inclination. Shem ena kadosh baruch hu matira yisaena beisur. For if a kadosh baruch hu doesn't say, "Okay, you can marry this captive woman," he's going to do it anyway. But at least this way, there are parameters and limitations and controls that are in place. Fine. But says Rashi, Aval im nas'a, but no, be warned, if he marries her, sofo liyot son'a, he is destined to despise her. As it says, ki tiena l'ish, tiena shima chata uva v'chat snua. And sofo lo lid mimena ben sorer u'moreh, she will eventually give birth to a child who will lead a rebellious life. As it says. Next paragraph. And lachem nismuchu parshiyot alalu. That's why these stories are all juxtaposed to each other. Now, the truth is that that's pretty far-fetched. That's pretty far-fetched to suggest that from a marriage with a yifat toar, a woman captured in battle, you could potentially have a situation where you have more than one wife, and one is loved and one is not loved, and from that union you'll have a birth of a child, and that child will be rebellious and lead to rebellions and eventually hang from a tree. That sounds pretty far-fetched, does it not? Do we ever hear such a story?
Maybe it's the first wife that hates the second wife and not the husband.
Yeah, maybe. We'll come back to the wife hating in a second. But has anybody ever heard of such a story? It's really quite an extraordinary story that the Torah has now woven together in four parashiyot. Except for the fact that it's not so far-fetched and it's not so far afield. Who is Ma'acha bat Tamai Melech Geshur? Who is this Ma'acha, mother of Avshalom and Tama? And I'm going to stop sharing for a second. Who is this Ma'acha, mother of Avshalom and Tamar? Ma'acha, daughter of Tamai, king of Geshur. Either a political marriage or, as Chazal say, marriage born out of the battlefield of the war with Geshur, right? Yifat Toar. Okay, part one. And from that union, from that marriage, David now finds himself with Achinom Israelit and mother of Avshalom and Ma'acha, mother of, Achinom Israelit, mother of Amnon, Ma'acha, mother of Avshalom, and Chagit, we'll talk about in the Daniel, and Batsheva, and before you know it, you have multiple wives, some, let's call it, more loved than others, or to put it in a different language, Ahava and Sinah, as we've said many times, is less an emotional state as much as it is a reflection of choice. As I just spoke about on Shabbos, when the notion that God, the pasuk we say every morning, the bracha we say every morning in davening, Habocher b'amo Yisrael be'ahava, God who chooses Israel with love, or the phrase in the davening of Yontav, Atah b'chartanu mikol amim ahavta otanu, you chose us, you love us. Right? Love in Tanakh is often synonymous with bechira, with choice. A person can have two wives. One is ahuva and one is snua, not because he loves one over the other, but because one is chosen and one is his primary and one is his secondary. Or to put it in different language, one is his wife and one is his pilegesh. Not uncommon. One is his wife, and one is his eshet yifat toar. One is Achinom Israelit, and the other is Ma'acha bat Tamai Melech Geshur. And from that union is born Avshalom. Avshalom is such a good boy. Avshalom never raised his voice. Avshalom never raised his hand. Avshalom never killed anybody. Avshalom never led a rebellion against his father that led to tens of thousands of Israelites dying on the battlefield. Ultimately, Avshalom hanging from his hair on a tree where Yoav comes and kills him in the battle In other words, Chazal took a look at this parak and said, in this parak, you have the story of Avshalom, from Ma'acha, Eshet Yifat Toar, down to Avshalom's rebellion, down to his hanging on the tree. It's all there. That's precisely, and the power of it is that that's how the Mefarshim saw it. Now come back to this, and I'll show you just a couple of examples. Rabbeinu Bachaye. Rabbeinu Bachaye goes to the same story. Rabbeinu Bachaye was a student of the Ramban. It goes to the same story that Rashi went through. Nismacha leParsha Zu, these parshiot are put together, and it tells us that if you have an Eshet Yifat Toar, in the end he's going to hate her, and then from her is going to give birth to a child who's going to be rebellious. Fine. All that's in Rashi. Then adds the Rabbeinu Bachaye. Mechein Matzinu B'David. We have exactly this precedent in the story of David. Shalakachet ma'acha bito bat shal tamay melech Geshur b'tzeto l'mechama. He marries ma'acha in the midst of battle against tamay melech Geshur. Eishet yifator. Yatzam emenu Avshalom, from which was born Avshalom, who sought to kill him, shebikesh lahargo, who took David's pilagshot, he took his concubines and slept with them publicly as part of his rebellion, v'shechavim nashav le'eneko Yisrael. And he led an entire rebellion, a war in Israel against David. Tens of thousands of Israelites were killed. And that's precisely what the Medrash Tanhuma identifies, the same sequence. The story of David is exactly this story. And it all starts from this conflict between the status of the primary wife and the Pilegesh, or the secondary wife. And the conflict that ensues based on who is the child who will be the continuation of the father, if you will, or in the case of Yerusha, who will get the double portion, who is the Bechor, and in the case of the Malchus, who is going to be the heir to the throne. Amnon says it's me, and Avshalom says it's me. Avshalom could have even been the firstborn for all we know. But he's the child of the Yishvatoa, so Amnon says, what are you talking about? You can't be the firstborn. Your mother's not even an Israelite. And suddenly the dynamic between them is far more complex, because we realize the backdrop to the story is the context, the marriage, the status of Ma'acha bat Talmai Melech Geshur is extraordinarily complicated. We don't even know the details. We don't even know when he marries her. But we do know that it is a complex piece of the story. Let's come back to Dvarim Chafala for a second. Achat Ova ve'achat Snua, these two wives. So we've talked about the wife and the Pilegesh. Certainly in the context of Dvarim Chafala, the Yifat Toar and the wife, because that's the normal context, right? He goes into battle, he sees her, he desires her, he takes her, and then he has his first wife, and that becomes the dynamic of Achat Ova ve'achat Snua, one loved and one despised. On the other hand, there's another context that can lead to exactly the same scenario. It's another context that can lead to the exact same scenario. The conflict between two wives, which one's primary, which one's secondary, which one is the chosen wife or the ahuva, and which one is the less chosen one, therefore the snu'a, and that conflict can end up as a conflict between the children. That's also possible. Anybody want to throw out a for instance? You have to unmute yourself to do that.
Yaakov.
Rachel and Leah?
No.
Right? Yaakov, Rachel and Leah. Yaakov loves Rachel and despises Leah, even though he marries Leah first. Leah's the first wife. Rachel's the second wife. On the other hand, Rachel is described as the one he loves. Leah is the one who's described as the one he doesn't love, because it's not about emotional attachment. It's about choice. Yaakov chose Rachel. Laban chose Leah. Complicated relationship. But does that not play out then in who is the firstborn amongst the children? Who is the leadership tribe amongst the children? Is it Yosef, to whom Yaakov chooses by giving the coat of Ketonet Pasim as a garment of Malchus, as we saw, And if that's a garment of Malchus, then he's choosing the younger second wife, even though the Bechor went to, should have gone to, the child, the first wife who was born first, in this case, was either Reuven, right? Or ultimately it came to Yehuda for reasons that are internal to Sefer Breishit. But that's exactly the conflict between Yaakov's children. The whole second half of Sefer Breishit revolves around exactly this question. And it's very possible that the Torah here is suggesting that we be careful and not make the mistake that Yaakov made. And choose based on our preference rather than choosing based on the firstborn of the father. This gets complicated because in the world of Malchus, it doesn't work that way.
So can we say Abraham and Sarah and Hagar were an issue?
And Abraham, Sarah and Hagar would also be exactly the same example. Only difference is that there, by divine decree, God said, I happen to agree with Sarah in this case. But that's exactly the same issue. I'll even go one step further. I'll even present, in the case of Rachel and Leah, how Yaakov ended up marrying both of them is complicated. Unfortunately, it was a part of the ruse. How the Torah describes the battlefield of the Yifat Toar is complicated, right? The man chooses to take a wife from the battlefield in addition to the wife that he has at home, and suddenly you have a very complex dynamic. Okay, but I'll paint you a third scenario that is far more kosher, but ends up in the same place. How many have you ever encountered, and I'm sure you have, this is a rhetorical question, but have you ever encountered a situation where family has, for whatever infertility issues are plaguing the family, the inability to have children for years and years and years and years and years, and they finally, after many decades, adopt a child, and then punked, she gets pregnant and has a child. You've heard this, right?
Me.
Okay? It happens. I'm not going to explain the science of it because I don't even begin to understand the science of it. I'm sure there's science behind it. Right? But the fascinating piece of it in the biblical context is that's exactly what happens with Abraham and Sarah. Avram and Sarah can't have children. They send in Hagar. Hagar has a child. The moment a year later, Sarah has a child. It's exactly what happened. Now, let's turn the clock back to the biblical arena for a second. Man has a wife, can't have children. Finally, he decides to take on the pilegesh to have a child. In modern society, we call it adopting. In the biblical arena, you take on a pilegesh, you have a child. Now the wife has a child. Who's the Bechor? Not so simple, right? Biologically, the child of the Pilegesh. From a perspective of the husband's wife, primary wife, the Ahuva over the Snua, it could be the second child. Very complicated scenario that I've just drawn. And when it gets, leaving out the question of Malchus, the context of Yerusha becomes a very big conflict. You know who suffered biblical character who suffered from exactly this conflict? Yiftach. Another story, happy-go-lucky story in Sefer Shoftim. Shoftim is just a happy-go-lucky story. What can I tell you? Yiftach. So Yiftach, Shoftim Yud Aleph, Yiftach begins, the story of Yiftach begins as follows. Yiftach ha-giladi haya gibor chayil hu haya isha zona. Yiftach was a warrior, but he was the son of a prostitute. Vayolad Gilad et Yiftach. His father's name was Gilad. Bateled eshet Gilad lo banim, but Mrs. Gilad bore him children. So wait a second. He has a prostitute and he has a wife? And they have children and they're all growing up in the same household. Vaygdalu b'nei ha'isha, the children of the wife grew up. And what did they do with Yiftach? They threw him out. Vaygashu at Yiftach. And they said to him, Lo tincha b'vet avinu. You will not inherit with our father. Ki ben isha acheret ata, because you are the son of a different woman. That's exactly the conflict. Now, this is a harsh term to call her a prostitute. So the Rabag says, but wait a second, she's not a prostitute. In the next sentence, it says that she's simply a second wife, Isha Acheret. So they call her a prostitute because they rejected her. But the only reason they rejected her is because she was either a Pilegesh, which is what the Radak says, or she could have even been from a different tribe, which is what the Rabag says. She was from a different tribe. And in those days, if you married somebody from a different tribe, it was like as if you married out. It was as if you married a shifu, or as if you married somebody else. A different tribe. It was a time of civil war between tribes. But the context here is very clear. Who was born first? Yiftach. And it could very well be that Esha Gilad had no children for many years, and so he took a second wife, and Isha Acheret, and Yiftach was born first, and then Esha Gilad had many other children, and they turned to Yiftach, and they said, you have no portion in our inheritance. Goodbye. That's exactly how the story of Yiftach begins, with all of its tragic consequences. And when you take a step back, and the pattern that emerges from all of these events, all of these stories, they all revolve around the same question: the status of the child from these unions, whether it be a Yifatoa, whether it be a Pilegesh, whether it be the second wife married in order to have children because the first wife couldn't have children, and then the first wife had children. And now the conflict over Yerusha, the conflict over status. And in the context of David, the conflict over Malchus. Who's the heir to the throne? So wait a second. Who's the firstborn? Who's the Bechor amongst David's children?
Amnon.
Amnon is the Bechor. But then why, when David takes a step back from the leadership after the story of Bathsheba, why is Avshalom drawing making all the decisions? Why is Avshalom in the driver's seat? Why is Avshalom leading the charge? Why is Amnon feigning ill because he desires Avshalom's sister, but he can't ask Avshalom for her hand? Why is Avshalom in the driver's seat? Now, it could be that he just is that kind of personality, or it could be that Avshalom is actually the older one. He's the Ben Hasnua. He's the child of the Yifator, who he married in battle, and he had a child, and Avshalom was born first. Except that he's the child of a non-Israelite, he's the child of a Yifator, he's the child of a Pilegesh, he's the child of a political marriage. Whatever status you want to give to him. And therefore, he passed over. And so the Torah, the Navi says, so who is considered the firstborn? Who is considered the heir to the throne or next in line to the throne? Amnon. Now, you understand, in David's worldview, neither Amnon nor Avshalom will ever sit on his throne. Why? Because who is he going to put on his throne?
Shlomo.
The child of Bathsheba, correct. The child of Bathsheba, unborn yet, because he's still going through that process of all the children that she has that don't survive, right? But that child, he's promised the throne to Bathsheba. But that's also part of the story. He loves Bathsheba. Bathsheba is his ahuva. But then he has all these other wives who he's rejected, he's pushed aside from Michal and on. And the conflict that is ensuing is a conflict over the meluch, it's a conflict over the reins of the leadership of the kingdom. And Amnon sits there and says, you Avshalom, you Tamar, children of Macha, daughter of Tamai, Eshet Geshur, you are going to succeed to the throne. Who am I, chopped liver? What? Flip it around for a second. Now he wants to marry Tamar. Maybe that'll solidify his claim to the throne. Maybe. That probably would give him a larger claim to the throne. He wants Tamar's hand in marriage. Why he does what he does is inexplicable and inexcusable. But he wants Tamar, but he can't get Tamar because who's standing in his way? This we said 2 weeks ago. Who's standing in his way? Avshalom. Avshalom. So Yonadav comes up with a brilliant plan, which is you bypass Avshalom, you go straight to David. Avshalom's going to take that sitting down. You understand that everything that is emerging in this story is around the conflict between Amnon and Tamar, between Amnon and Avshalom, less about Tamar. She's not only the victim, she's also the context, that the catalyst to it all. But the conflict is between Amnon and Avshalom, and over the status of Amnon and over the status of Avshalom as the child of Machabat Tamai Melech Geshur, whoever he is. And we don't know that story because we don't have that story in Tanakh. We only have the Medrash analysis of what that could be. But from what I have described, it's not so far afield to attribute it to some context of Yifatoa or Pilegesh or some status, political marriage, whatever the context is. Amnon says, my mother was an Israelite. My mother comes from Emek Israel. You can't get more Jewish than that. Who are you? Daughter of the grandson of the king of Geshur? Whoever Geshur is. I'm clear whether it's down by Egypt or down up in near the Golan. It's either Syrian or Egyptian. So he does what he does. And in his mind, he kind of can do no wrong because he's the heir to the throne. Avshalom has a different take on the world. Avshalom takes care of business. Avshalom blames David as much as he blames Amnon. But David's out of reach. He invited David to his party, right? He invited David to his shearing the wool party. David, was at least smart enough to turn Avshalom down. And when it's all done, where does Avshalom run to? When it's all done, and Avshalom commits the ultimate...
Goes to his grandfather's.
Yeah, his grandfather's house.
Exactly right.
Right.
Avshalom runs. Avshalom barach. Bayelech el Talmai ben Amihud Melech Geshur. And just in case we had any doubt that the story here somehow links us back to the status of his mother and her lineage as the king of, as the granddaughter of the prince or the princess of the kingdom of Geshur, the story ends when Avshalom runs to begin to plan his rebellion in the courts of Tamai Melech Geshur, his grandfather. That's the story. So we started with an analogy, just to kind of recap an intense year today, but we started with a comparison between the story of Amnon and Tamar and Pilegesh Begib, which really links us in language, links us in horrificness of the crime, but also tells us, wait a second, inject into the story the Pilegesh status, and suddenly we have a window into a new question. Who is Ma'acha? What is her status? And could this be at the center of the conflict between Amnon and Avshalom to call into question the status of their mother? For that, we went back to the Yifator phenomenon in Chumash and saw the Yifator, the two wives, the whole status of the chapter revolving around this similar question, whether it be a Pilegesh or whether it be a second wife to have children or whether it be a Fatar, all of them have essentially revolving around the same question, which is these moments that create children from unions where the lines of inheritance and the lines of leadership are not clearly demarcated. And that leads to the conflict. We saw it by Yiftach, and ultimately we brought it back to the story of Amnon and of Shalom. And they all lived happily ever after.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Is there at any time, did Amnon or Avshalom know or were told or heard that Shlomo would eventually have the Malchus?
At this stage of the game, I don't, again, Shlomo's not born yet.
Right.
Shlomo, according to what we said at the end of Perek Yudbet, isn't born until after Avshalom dies, because Shlomo's named Shlomo after Avshalom. Okay, so he is born as the fifth child, or the right fourth. So there's 5 years at least. So he's born, assuming that he's the fifth child of Bathsheba, that's the Arba Atayim, he's born later, even though he's mentioned in Perek Yudbet. So I don't think the promise is about Shlomo. I think the promise is about Bathsheba. And yes, I think that his loyalty to Bathsheba was a statement. Bathsheba is my wife. Bathsheba is going to be my queen. And Bathsheba is going to be the mother of the next king. I think that was David's perspective. And I suspect that the people rejected it for that reason. Right? And that's why the conflict begins, because they rejected Bathsheba and they rejected David's loyalty to Bathsheba. So yes, I think that that's part of the dynamic.
Okay.
By the way, in Rabbi Sachs's book, Covenant and Conversation, he says, when talking about next week's parasha, exactly what you said 5 minutes ago. He says, in no story of family in the book of Bereshit does it say, and they lived happily ever after.
Yes. I don't think it says it anywhere in Chumash, actually. But or anywhere in Tanakh for that matter. But I've often said that we have this perception that Tanakh is inspiring and enhancing and feel good. And unfortunately, Tanakh is a chronicle of every mistake we've ever made in history. And we have to remember that that's how it was written. It was written to Nachumetz Chumash, but certainly Nach, to chronicle everything we ever did wrong. So, if we ever did things right, and we did things right many times, but if we ever did things right, all Tanakh ever said was the land was quiet for 40 years. Nobody ever wrote a story about what we did right. But do things wrong, and whoa, we got chapter after chapter after chapter. That's the nature of the beast. It is what it is, and we have chosen to study it in depth. So if you still have the stomach to come back next week, we will see you all then.
Yasher Koach, thank you so
much. Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.
My pleasure.
It was intense, very intense.